You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Higher Power by Joel Stein. Hollywood and Divine, searching for salvation and the authentic in L.A.'s booming hipster ministries. Opening photo illustration by Selman Hosker. Chad Veach, Judah Smith, Kanye West, Joseph Barkley, Chris Pratt, Justin Bieber, Erwin McManus, and Angela Davis. Shown here superimposed on the Hollywood sign and a stained glass window. I am in the mosh pit of West Hollywood's El Rey Theater, jangly from two cups of Zoe Ministries' excellent self-branded coffee. 20-somethings in mom jeans, sneakers, and colorful baggy shirts are singing Disney radio-inflected anthems about God while we gently shoulder bump one another. Soon, preacher Chad Veach takes the stage in a baseball cap, rainbow-hued kicks, and a denim jacket that says Veach on the back. He bounces on the balls of his feet, referring to Jesus' disciples as his crew. Whenever he says anything vaguely profound, people yell, "Wow!" which is the amen of cool young churches. Veach warns the first row they're going to get wet from his spit. He's preaching pure Pentecostalism. And I'm prepared for snake handling, for speaking in tongues, for a deaf man to hear and then say that the music here is a little generic. Veach is part of the new Great Awakening. Interest in Christianity is blossoming in America's biggest, bluest cities, partly promoted by celebrity Zoe-goers such as Chris Pratt and Katherine Schwarzenegger. Young people listen to Spotify list of songs performed by the bands at one-name churches that sound like rehab centers. Hillsong, a global megachurch that started in Australia. Mosaic, VU, Radius, Church Home. The center of this great awakening is Los Angeles, where the word comes in many denominations. In January, Kanye West started hosting Sunday service, at which Tyler, the Creator, Katy Perry, Orlando Bloom, Kid Cudi, DMX, and 070 Shake have listened to him sing about God. On Easter, West built a hill on a fenced-in area attached to the Coachella Music Festival, joining in with a chorus in matching mauve ponchos. Halfway through the service, Veach, who likes to say that Zoe is pronounced Zoe like Beyonce, slows his sermon down. His 34-year-old brother-in-law, he informs the crowd, was supposed to preach this Sunday for the first time, but he had a stroke while on vacation with his family and died. It's shocking and tragic. And then Veach reveals that his daughter, Georgia, who has an incurable brain disorder that will likely prevent her from ever walking or talking, got more disheartening news. He has a G tattoo in her honor, as do Zoe regulars Justin Bieber, Hailey Baldwin, Selena Gomez, and Ashley Benson. The sermon suddenly feels authentic. There's a man in front of me, grappling with his faith. Then I realize that all that has preceded this, the merch giveaway from children's pastor Tommy Two Guns, the number for automatic text tithing, The promo video that looked like it was for the next Saw was equally authentic to these young Angelenos. When Veach asked the non-believers to accept Jesus, nearly 200 raised their hands. I want to lift my atheist arm to feel whatever they're feeling, but my hand won't go, which makes me wonder if God is real and is keeping me honest. As I leave, a millennial couple ask if I was at Radius, another cool church, this morning. I had indeed drunk freshly ground third-wave coffee there as Pastor Joseph Barkley, the tattooed former lead singer of a worship band called Plumline, asked us to write a wish for God on a construction paper leaf and affix it to a wall. I wrote, "I want to believe," on mine. On the leaf next to mine, someone had written, "Sick people get Yeezys and get better." The pair who approached me, L.A. newcomers, Alexa and Evan Henderson, are Great Awakening devotees. They rock out to church band CDs, listen to the church's podcast, and say things such as, "We want it real." Church home pastor Judah Smith, like his friend Veach, a veteran of Seattle's Pentecostal scene, tells me that young people are thirsty for both authenticity and spirituality. They have access to their heroes and know that they're disconnected too. We are going, "Geez, if Kanye is not happy being Kanye, we're all screwed," he says over egg whites at an outside table at Jones on 3rd in Studio City. As he's talking, he spots his bro Ryan Good walking by, wearing a sweatshirt he designed himself with a photo of the late rapper Nipsey Hussle. Good was Bieber's swagger coach and started the Drew House clothing line with him. "I hated him at first," says Good about meeting Smith backstage at a Bieber show in Everett, Washington. "I had a perception that pastors are weird guys trying to be cool. They pop up on tour. It's more prevalent since celebrity pastors became cool." After some encouragement from Bieber, the two became friends, and Smith began flying to L.A. from Seattle, where he still runs the church on Sundays and pastors the Seahawks, to conduct a weekday Bible class at the home of Good's friend, E! News host Jason Kennedy. When they attracted so many faithful that the cops broke it up, they moved to increasingly larger venues until it became a church, filling the Saban Theater, a 2,000-seat Art Deco venue in Beverly Hills. Like Veach and other Great Awakening pastors, Smith is trying to make church less unapproachably country club. What's so sacred about Sunday, a tabernacle, or a stained glass window, he asked. If he and Veach and so many other preachers were raised on hip-hop, isn't it authentic to talk like that? To play that music? To dress in streetwear? In March, a church-going tech guy in Texas started documenting preachers' expensive clothes in an Instagram account called @preachersandsneakers, which now has nearly 170,000 followers and a spinoff podcast. It exposes the prosperity gospel implied by this new breed of ministries. Tithe to your church, and God will rain Gucci sweatpants on your soul. I felt so sad that I dishonored Jesus, says the Dean of Cool L.A. Preachers, Mosaic Pastor Irwin McManus, 60, after At Preachers and Sneakers called him out for wearing a $1,000 pair of Air Jordan 1 retro highs. "My kids were the opposite. They're like, 'Dad, you need to wear something really dope on stage, because you cannot be controlled by people.'" McManus, who once ran a fashion line, started many of the cool church trends, such as preaching from a stool. He held his services at a dance club. He got rid of words such as church and sermon. Even with the Bible, I call it the Scriptures because I feel like it feels more sacred. Bible sounds more like Bible Belt, Southern, and conservative. McManus, who is not Pentecostal, is a longtime TED donor and attendee. His Easter sermon included the phrases black holes and a universe ever expanding. Last he checked, a fifth of the Mosaic attendees were atheist. His service felt warm and artistic, not preachy. I enjoyed it, as well as his books and the great blue bottle coffee Mosaic served. But I confessed that I didn't feel anything. I couldn't raise my hand when he asked people to proclaim their conversion. Over coffee, 3 days later, McManus considers my dilemma and says, "Can I get you to go to a soul cycle class?" A week later, I am cranking my legs to the commands of Mosaic member and spin instructor Angela Davis, sister of Jerry Lorenzo, the founder of the label Fear of God, who created looks for Bieber on his Purpose World Tour. A few weeks earlier, Ciara, a regular at Church Home, performed live during this class, but today we are listening to pre-recorded hip-hop. "Your best life is not for sale. You have to earn it," Davis keeps repeating as we sweat. "By surrounding myself with people of faith," McManus has told me, "I can open myself up to feeling it." So I invite the Hendersons, the cool church aficionados, to Church Home with me. I grab a delicious ritual coffee in the lobby, and within a few minutes, Pastor Judah Smith appears in glasses and a tan corduroy jacket designed by Drew House. He takes a stool, prefacing Luke 7:18-23 with, "This is so Jesus." After he finishes, a band sings out, "Even when I can't feel it, you're working." I close my eyes and raise my palm outward to heaven, along with everyone around me, hoping to feel something. And I do. Evan Henderson has put his hand on my back. It feels strange being touched by a relative stranger, but it feels good, too, like we're feeling something together, even if we're feeling different things. I don't feel God, but I don't feel alone, either. It's the most I've ever felt in a religious setting, and I believe, I truly do believe, that it is authentic. Thank you. idol worship. When Grace Jones hit Zendaya's Tommy Hilfiger spring runway, the power pairing foretold an amped-up summer look. Nightclub excess meets millennial verve. Force majeure, Grace Jones in a 1980s portrait by Kwame Brathwaite, in which she wears a hat that looks like a gold record on her head. Gilded Age, Pat McGrath calls Jones forever iconic. Pat McGrath labs idols in Enraptured, $25, and this is eyeshadow, gold eyeshadow. Lacquered up, a glossy lip tint begs a Studio 54 reboot. YSL Beauté Water Stain in Wet Vermilion, $37. Next Gen, the new scent fronted by Zendaya, pictured here, hints at the iPhone. Lancome Idol for $123. And the shape of the bottle is very much like an iPhone. Flash Zone, Jones Nose Glow, Glossier Play Nightshine in Molten Umber, $20. Great looking bronzer. Gotcha by Rachel Dodds. Unreasonable Doubt. Social media loves a good spat. The weapon of choice? Receipts. Opening photo illustration by Justin Patrick Long. Tati Westbrook, James Charles, Moby, Natalie Portman, Donald Trump, Ken Todd, Lucy Applejuice, Taylor Swift, Kim Kardashian West. Shown here in this montage. The receipts are everywhere, crumpled in corners, condensed in clouds, spilling out into Instagram feeds. William Barr better have the receipts on the Russia probe, read a recent headline on CNN. On MSNBC's official Hardball Instagram account last summer, former Trump advisor Omarosa Manigault-Newman teased an appearance on the show, saying, "I'm talking Michael Cohen, and I brought some receipts." The Real Housewives franchise has become so reliant upon receipts that Bravo should embrace its future as an auditing firm. Our culture is an overstuffed wallet after a 2-week business trip, awaiting an epic reimbursement that sadly will never be credited to our account. Before we all become keepers of compromat, armed with our smartphones and our unlimited data storage plans, receipts were pieces of paper, documents, demonstrating that some good or service had been purchased. Then along came Whitney Houston, credited with the modern coinage in 2002. "I want to see the receipts," she said in an interview with Diane Sawyer in response to the allegation that she had spent $730,000 on drugs. Demanding proof of purchase from a drug dealer to validate a tabloid headline was a genius retort, verging on Dadaist, a rejection of the premise of the question itself. The exchange quickly became legendary, according to the Oxford English Dictionary blog, as the quote, revived by viral YouTube clips and then GIFs, became a colloquial way to insist upon proof, even and especially when none exist. Over the past few years, the concept of receipts has expanded to connote any form of documentation that cast one party in a dispute in a positive light while revealing the other to be an abomination. James Comey's contemporaneous notes were receipts. So were the screenshots of rapper Azalea Banks' text messages with Grimes, a recording artist who is dating embattled Tesla co-founder Elon Musk, about the errant tweet that caused Musk to be charged with fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission and later stepped down as chairman of the board as part of a settlement with the agency. Banks and Grimes have been ordered by the court to hang on to those receipts as they now face potential subpoenas in a class action suit brought by Tesla investors. In the court of social media, if not actual court, the receipt has emerged as the ultimate power play, the secret spice in our unsavory clapback culture stew. But the receipts, alas, have not delivered on their promise of truth, justice, and mutual understanding. Like anything else, we decide which receipts support the narrative that we already believe to be true. The current deluge of digital receipts and the social acceptability of sharing them can be traced back to the summer of 2016, when Kim Kardashian West dropped a stack on her husband's nemesis, Taylor Swift. The abbreviated backstory: Kanye West claimed Swift was in on the joke when he rapped that he was responsible for her fame. I made that bitch. Swift feigned ignorance and insult. Kardashian showed up to the rescue during season 12 of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and just as her own cover of GQ was to be released, posting a video to Snapchat showing West on the phone with Swift, her voice emanating from the speaker, thanking him for the heads up. The video was hailed as the ultimate receipt, proof that West was a magnanimous truth-teller, and that far from being an innocent ingenue, Swift was a calculating operator. Most of all, Kardashian West earned a reputation as a patient hoarder of receipts. Cross her at your peril. In the wake of the 2016 election, receipts captivated the public imagination as the adhesive that would somehow tether us to the facts in a world awash in fake news. But we were naive. The receipts had already jumped the shark. Just prior to Trump's inauguration, and amid a public outcry over his business entanglements, the president-elect was desperate to demonstrate his compliance with pesky ethics guidelines. Cue the documents. Trump's transition team orchestrated a press conference, a ham-handed exercise in stagecraft, featuring the president-elect standing beside a table piled high with stacks of papers and manila folders, containing who knows what. But it didn't matter. The so-called proof was beyond reproach, referenced by Trump and his lawyers any time a journalist had a question. Never mind that reporters were not allowed to view them, or, more importantly, that they appeared to the untrained eye to consist of blank pages. Far from holding any revelations, the papers were a distraction from the obvious reality that turning over the family business to Eric and Don Jr., as opposed to divesting it or putting it in a blind trust, would never free the president from conflicts of interest. Demonstrating conflicts of interest, or a lack thereof, would be a legitimate justification for maintaining receipts, as would saving evidence of automobile accidents, human rights violations, constitutional crises, legal disputes, and last but not least, retail purchases. I am not talking about those situations, though. I'm talking about Moby posting to Instagram photos with his arm around Natalie Portman, These photographic receipts, a visual sort of gaslighting, were intended to prove that Portman was lying when she said that she and Moby had never dated, contradicting Moby's claims in his recent memoir. The photos proved nothing except that Moby is creepy. He has since deleted the photos and apologized to Portman for not giving her advance notice. I'm also talking about Ken Todd, the husband of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Lisa Vanderpump, who printed out text messages between castmate Teddy Mellencamp Arrieve and a man named John Blizzard, and brandished them like a weapon to adjudicate a fight centered on a dog named Lucy Lucy Applejuice. The receipts, as well as the origins of the dispute, remain too complex to untangle. And I am talking about Tati Westbrook and James Charles, the beauty vloggers, embroiled in a quarrel so shocking in its pettiness that the YouTube videos chronicling their argument, the claims and counterclaims, and so many receipts, got 3 times more views than the Game of Thrones finale. Never before has more attention been devoted to something so idiotic. So how did we find ourselves in this dispiriting avalanche of evidence? One theory, receipt culture, has been triggered by the convergence of a thriving surveillance-based economy and a society lacking any sense of discretion. Back when we used to keep our actual receipts locked up in a file cabinet or secreted away on a hard drive, few would have predicted that everyone would one day be able to amass an infinite dossier of dirt and maintain it in perpetuity in a thing called the cloud, to be unleashed on the world at some future date. It's almost as if we've discovered a new superpower, using receipts to attain selfish personal ends without realizing that the receipts debase us. We are all James Charles, searching for the perfect moment to hoist Tati Westbrook on her own petard. In 2019, we're learning that just because you have receipts doesn't make them irrefutable. Look at that doctored video of Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi that appeared to show her stuttering. The one that got more than 6 million views on Twitter after Trump posted it. The incident marked the dawn of our new, more complicated era of receipts. In the run-up to 2020, we will contend with the scourge of strategically edited content, weaponized tools of political disinformation presented as proof. If only technology could instead be the solution, a way to objectively evaluate the receipts and show when and whether they had been altered, we could get on with our lives with renewed confidence in objective truth. I think I'm talking about the blockchain here. Currently, the domain of cryptocurrency enthusiasts, logistics executives, and security nerds, this technology ought to be leveraged to resolve all of our interpersonal conflicts. I propose the Real Housewives of the Blockchain, in which the cast spends each episode verifying their receipts. But that doesn't sound like a very fun show, does it? Vanity Fair's Women on Women, edited by Radhika Jones with David Friend. 35 years of classic Vanity Fair profiles, essays, and columns by women, about women. Available in October, wherever books are sold. Now here's this month's cover story, The Idris Experience. From prestige TV to tent pole franchises to the Coachella DJ tent, the British actor is a poster boy for 21st century fame. Multidisciplinary, omnipresent, engaging. K. Austin Collins tracks down the international man of maybe mystery to consider what we want from Idris Elba and how he delivers. Photographs by Collier Shore, styled by Ludovine Pueblin. Opening photo, leading man, Idris Elba, photographed in Los Angeles. In this photograph, Elba leans against an old-school card table, wearing a coat by Dior Men, pants by Louis Vuitton. He's smooth, obviously, and tall. An hour into meeting him, I can't help but continue to notice as much. We are deep into a conversation about growing up black and British in the 80s and wanting to be a movie star. What that must have felt like to young Idris Akuna Elba, the first-generation working-class son of Ghanaian and Sierra Leonean immigrants, who'd grown up in Hackney and East London's Canning Town, areas where the far-right National Front Party had strongholds. It's a complicated history. Needless to say, he tells me, if you were black and living in Canning Town, you were probably subject to racial abuse and getting chased down the street by people calling you a black coon. But he doesn't dwell, preferring to tell a different story. At 13, he met a drama teacher, a Welsh woman named Miss McPhee, who sparked something in him. I remember just being fascinated, he says. She'd be like, so, he slips into a lively declarative teacher voice, I want you guys to pretend to be a frying egg, an egg in a frying pan. What would that feel like? He imitates his fellow classmates, all of them rowdy teenage boys, refusing to participate. And then he gives me a rendition of his performance. A fury of convulsions, his mouth serving up popping and sizzling sounds, splattering grease by way of Daffy Duck. You're really good at that, he says, again channeling Miss McPhee. Have you ever fried yourself? Idris Elba, now 46, attractively grizzled and low-key in a T-shirt and trackies, is more fit than fried. He's wearing a shirt with the message, Don't Stab Your Future, a nod to the problem of knife crime, violent street offenses involving knives in England and Wales, which have seen a rapid increase in incidents in recent years, disproportionately affecting young men of color. After our interview, he's headed to appear on BBC's The One Show to talk about the issue. A privilege, he says, because having a massive soapbox is useful. He pauses to ask whether I mind if he smokes, and then takes a perch near an open window, leaning out of it with Marlboro poise, picturesque, but by no means fussy about it. This is when he really starts to answer the question, what was it like in the 80s, black, British, a working-class laborer like his father, with a dream of becoming a star? Who did he look to? There were a handful of black actors and performers in this country in the music space, he says, looking toward the window with each exhale. Reggae, which was a shared big UK experience. English people love reggae because the majority of black people in this country were from the Caribbean. They came with the music. So you were seeing on TV reggae bands, reggae white fusion bands, but in terms of actors, there were very few. There were standouts. The comedian Lenny Henry of The Lenny Henry Show, for example. But mostly, Elva grew up watching the black stars that black people worldwide, to say nothing of everyone else, were watching. Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, Richard Roundtree, and later, early career Wesley Snipes, and of course, Denzel Washington, who in the late 80s came to England to film for Queen and Country, the story of a black paratrooper who joins the British Army to escape poverty, fights in Northern Ireland and the Falklands War, and struggles to integrate when he returns home. Elba remembers reading later that Washington was getting an education about Black Britain during filming, one clarified for Elba when after moving to the States, he'd meet people who'd say, "You're English? There's black people there?" When I got to America and was like, "I want to be an actor," I was like a novelty act in all my casting meetings, Elba says. It was something the Americans hadn't encountered before and didn't know yet how to use. Now there are enough black Brits in Hollywood that an American actor like Samuel L. Jackson could, fairly or not, complain about what it means for his black American counterparts, as he did in 2017, and as characters on the newest season of Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It debated to some controversy just this spring. But that wasn't the climate in those casting sessions when Elba was starting out. They were like, "Wow, I love your accent. It's so refined," he says, eyes widened in imitation. And then, "Okay, so you're gangster number one." He has a sense of humor about it now. We'd agreed to meet in the cozy Camden Town offices of Elba's production company, Green Door Pictures. Founded in 2013, the company has yet to produce a film in which he or anyone of his caliber plays gangster number one. It likely never will. Those days are long behind him. His packed resume is proof enough. He's had 3 television series air over the past year alone, including the 5th season of his Emmy-nominated crime drama, Luther. His recent movie slate includes the release of Yardie, his directorial debut, an upcoming film adaptation of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats, and this month, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw. Further proof of Elba's ascendance, his office, which sits nondescript behind what looks like a posh, overlarge garage door fitted with white tinted windows. It's a work day. Downstairs, his staff is busy being busy. Upstairs, tucked away in a recording studio with a pair of producers, a promising young woman named Anna is laying down a track. Elba, an established DJ and recording artist, sees music as central to the mission of his production company. Same for his family. His 5-year-old son, Winston, named for Elba's father, is playing with his toys a room over from us, so quietly that I almost forget he's there. Elba has a teenage daughter, too, from his first marriage, though they don't live together. Meanwhile, there is news on the horizon. Not long after we meet, Elba announces that he's gotten married again in a sunny Marrakesh ceremony to the model Sabrina Dari. So, it's been a banner year, and frequently a surprising one. There's been a little more comedy than usual, what with the goofy self-effacement of his Netflix show Turn Up Charlie about a DJ bachelor who becomes a nanny, and a recent gig hosting Saturday Night Live for the first time. There have been the music successes, too. This April, he performed a slick 2-hour set offering his usual mix of house and hip-hop at Coachella that Vulture, hardly able to contain his surprise, called actually great, an accomplishment only bested in once-in-a-lifetime implausibility by his gig DJing at Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's royal wedding last May. The prince personally asked him to take the job. This is a far cry from the relative unknown who in the early aughts took the American television scene by storm with his depiction of Stringer Bell on HBO's The Wire. And Bell himself is a far cry from the man perched in front of me. Elba has a knack for lending his roles, even minor ones, an attractive veneer of mystery, which in person he lacks. 5 feet from you, he's an amicable, open, energetic, talkative man. That must be why they call it acting. Or maybe it's just the Stringer Bell effect. Whoever he is, you can't watch him without wondering where he's been and how he came to be, even when he is the bad guy. His is a movie star magnetism. Part of his appeal, you realize, is how utterly convinced you are that what he's giving you is honest. You believe it, whether you like it or not, and a fast-changing Hollywood seems to be liking it more and more. Next, photos. There are 2 black-and-white photos showing Elba dressed in baggy dark pants, a white T-shirt, and a leather jacket thrown over a chair. And another photo where Elba stands in a doorway wearing black jeans, a black belt, a white T-shirt, and a tan camel hair coat. Elba was born in 1972 on the heels of multiple African and Caribbean exoduses to England. He was part of a generation of British-born blacks whose identities seemed multiply bound to each part of those migrations, not to mention, in Elba's case, of his working-class upbringing. Next photos. Elba is looking off into the distance, wearing a coral-colored knit sweater, a turtleneck, and in a black and white photo, he hangs from a jungle gym, wearing a leather jacket, white T-shirt, dark pleated pants, and a dark leather belt. Again, looking into the distance. Captioned, "Look ahead." Elba has honed his suave but down-to-earth intelligence as he's pushed further into the mainstream. His new Sky Network show, In the Long Run, which is kind of like Everybody Hates Chris, based on my life in the 80s, is about the early chapters of his life in Hackney and Canningtown. He plays his father on the show, a man he describes as a smooth cat, his biggest male influence in life. The project helped him understand his father a little better. Every now and again, he says, I get these moments of real emotional tension because I'm playing my life back in the 80s, and there are moments where I'm like, wow, I remember this storyline and this. I see it reenacted, and I'm playing him, and I'm thinking, oh shit, my dad was going through that. It's a weird art imitating life, life imitating art sort of thing. His father worked for nearly 25 years at the Ford Dagenham auto plant, eventually becoming a shop steward after years on the factory floor. Soon after leaving school, Elba joined him, not exactly willingly. I was 19, doing the night shift, he says, It's not for anyone. So it just made me think, man, when I get into acting and make it full time, I'm going to work hard, because if I can do this job all night, mundane, boring, repetitive, then I'm going to be able to act. Elba's transition to screen acting is by now well known. He arrived in New York long before he was legally eligible to work in the States, hustling to get auditions. He came over on his summer holidays. The routine of going to casting calls was drudgery for any actor, but particularly for a black actor, and most especially for one with the size and stature of a ready-made gangster or basketball player. Gigs came. One, a pilot for Fox filmed in Canada, gave him a visa that allowed him to hop to the States for auditions when the time came. He moved to New York in 1997 and kept working, bouncing, selling weed. He landed The Wire in 2001. You wouldn't know from the mythos of Stringer Bell that he didn't live past the third of the show's five seasons. So essential was he to the fabric of its ideas about black life and black enterprise. David Simon, the series creator, told me that at the time of his departure, Elba wasn't certain that his career was secure. Simon was. I remember saying to him, "Once this airs, once they see the end of your arc, if not already, you're going to have more work than you need. You're going to be doing films as a leading man," says Simon. And he rolled his eyes and said, "From your lips to God's ears." The prediction bore out. Elba's career was pulled in multiple promising directions immediately afterward, some of which draw more attention than others. There was the return home to England to star in Luther. There's the long run of franchise roles, many of them supporting, that have formed the backbone of his mainstream Hollywood career. Less discussed, but just as important, are the several roles Elba took in black American movies immediately after The Wire. Films like The Gospel, This Christmas, Daddy's Little Girls, and Obsessed, in which he played a maybe-cheating husband to one Beyoncé Knowles. These weren't prestigious movies. Someone glancing at his IMDb page is likely to overlook them in favor of his bigger, better work. But for Elba, they were essential. "Yes, The Wire was a big show," he says, "but it wasn't the biggest show at all. And the reason HBO extended the storyline to three seasons instead of one is because of the upsurge in African-American subscribers." When he left the show, black producers and directors, Will Packer, Tyler Perry, and the crew, as Elba puts it, offered him a slate of roles that would make him a recognizable movie star for the black public specifically. "The beginning of my world outside The Wire started there," says Elba, who has for the most part left those films behind. Now we've grown into this much, much bigger highway. And not only African-Americans are watching African-American films, there's a wider spectrum of audience. He's had his eye on bigger fish lately. His ambition seems to be to push the suave but down-to-earth intelligence he's honed in his career to date into the mainstream, an aim that recently seemed to hit as yet invisible limit. One that surprises anyone who's grown to associate Elba with heroic complexity, protagonist whose moral heroism constantly wavers. I'm talking, of course, about Bond, James Bond. Rumors of his serving as the next 007 have taken on a strange and outsized place in Elba's professional narrative these last few years, and with good reason. It would be an ideal role for Elba, you'd think. Speculation that Elba would be hired as the first black James Bond was sparked in part by a 2018 survey in The Hollywood Reporter claiming that 63% of Americans wanted him for the role. A reflection of, if nothing else, the changing times. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.